You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott. Hi, everybody. And we have a nice rally on Wall Street again today as the major averages recover almost all of yesterday's losses. The Dow is now on pace to close at the highest level since March 10th. It's up 355 points right now. The S&P crossing above its 100-day moving average for the first time since February. It's up 48 points. Across the board, we're seeing gains about 1.5%. The Nasdaq is up 170. And oil is getting a nice boost on signs of improving demand and a surprise drawdown in inventories. The energy sector, believe it or not, is actually the top performer in the market right now. WTI crude is up about 3%, so not a huge move in size, but it's the level, $33 a barrel for that now July contract, which we have rolled over to. And all of this as we await the results of the 20-year bond auction. This is the first time we've seen a 20-year auction since 1986. The Treasury needs to issue a lot of debt to fund its coronavirus relief efforts. We'll have the latest on that in just a moment. First, let's get more on these markets with Bob Pisani. Bob?
And I am, we are off of the highs, but I am very encouraged by the action today because I see broadening of the market, which happened on Monday as well. Let me just show you what's up today. And again, it's not just that we're up, it's what's up today. So I see the Russell 2000 outperforming today, outperforming the S&P 500. I think that's important. I see the transports outperforming. I see banks outperforming. I see energy and industrials outperforming. All this stuff was laggards for a long, long time. Now it's starting to exert itself a little bit. 1 month, let's look at where we are. This is starting to be a trend. So energy stocks are outperforming the S&P in the last month. Russell 2000's outperforming the S&P. Transports are. Only thing that's lagging a little bit are the banks. That's still a little bit of a disappointment. We'll keep an eye on that. Elsewhere, I want to point out social media is having a very good day. Facebook's knocking the cover off the ball. We got a new high on Facebook. They're making a big push into online shopping through Facebook Shop. So that's kind of helping Twitter and Snap and even Alphabet is moving to the upside. And by the way, yes, the rally's still partly on those mega cap names, the FANG names. If you just take a look in the last month, I'm just picking a 1 month period here. Facebook's up almost 30%. I mean, these stocks are just flying. Apple, Alphabet, strong. Only Microsoft and Amazon a little more modest, and they're only in line with the S&P 500. Guys, back to you.
Yeah, they're only underperforming because they never were that bad to begin with. But this is exactly the theme we're about to pick up on, Bob. Thank you, sir. As stocks have rebounded sharply off of those March lows, the clear market winners are growth stocks. The Russell Growth ETF has outperformed the Russell Value ETF over the past month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, and year to date, growth is up about 1% on the year, while value is down 21%. And if the year ended today, that would be the biggest growth outperformance since 1999, according to Dow Jones. And the latest Bank of America fund manager survey shows the most crowded trade in the market is, yes, growth stocks, and expectations for value to underperform growth are at their highest level now since 2007. So can the growth sprint last? And what an interesting day to talk about this. Joining me now are Bill Smead, the chief investment officer of Smead Capital Management, and Kim Forrest, who is chief investment officer of Boca Capital Partners. And almost by accident, we have a value guy and a growth girl here to talk about this split. Bill, I'll start with you. As Bob just highlighted, the value, so to speak, segment of the market is outperforming today. I almost hate to ask because we've talked so many times about whether this is a turning point and, you know, these trends might reverse. But is this a turning point? And do you think this is a more significant shift towards value underway?
Well, I've said many times in the last year to 2 years that I would not hold my breath waiting for that turn. The exacerbation that Bob Pisani referred to right before we came on is typical of a change point. At a change point, the thing that had done great for the prior 5 to 10 years goes gaga at the end. And the thing that had done terrible for the prior 5 to 10 years does extra terrible at the end. So we have all the pieces in place for the changeover to happen. And by the way, it only makes sense from a valuation standpoint. When growth stocks were way out of favor at some point 10 years ago, they had a two-pronged thing working for them. You have a cheapness to begin with and then momentum from the success of the businesses. The same thing works in value also. The only problem is these things usually get rectified when growth is a big winner by some severe crushing of growth stocks, a.k.a. 73, 74, a.k.a. 2000, 2003. So the problem is everybody that's playing these nice woogie moves to the upside is begging for historical trouble.
Interesting. But before I continue this discussion, we just got the results of the 20-year auction. And if you'll wait a moment, I do want to get to Rick Santelli. Rick, this is the first 20-year auction since 1986. Treasury's issuing a flood of new debt to fund the coronavirus relief spending. How'd it go off?
You know, I'm going to give it a B with the Roger Maris asterisk, and I'll tell you why in a second. So $20 billion, 20 years, first auction in decades. The Dutch auction yield that everybody gets, 1.22%. It was pretty much spot on with where the when-issued market was trading. Bid to cover, 2.53. Indirect, 60.7. Direct, 14.7. Primary dealers take 24.6%. And very quickly, directs are basically domestic players, you know, large hedge funds, mutual funds, insurance companies. Indirects are mostly foreign entities, think foreign central banks. But here's what I did. I did a custom Rick blend. I blended the 10 and 30-year auction, 10 auction averages for bid to cover indirects, directs, and primary dealers. And then here's the results that we had today for the actual 20-year auction. You can see it's pretty good. So the reason I gave it a B, since it's the first auction, it's hard to have a history, is because based on the blending of 10 and 30 over the last 10 auctions, that really jumped out. It was well contained. That means for every dollar's worth of securities, $2.53 were chasing it. So I gave it a B based on history, and I have a feeling that this 20-year is going to be highly successful. If for nothing else, all the seasoned 30-year bonds out there end up being deliverable into this contract. Kelly and the gang, back to you.
Rick, I just have a follow-up question, which is, you know, if Treasury is going to be issuing a ton of debt, part of the argument is, well, why not make it as long-term as possible? Now, the idea that they might do 50 years was floated. 100 years was sort of floated, sort of not. I mean, why not issue really, really long-term debt? Is there just not the appetite among the buyers that you mentioned for it?
Makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Here's the issue. The issue is that it would take a long time to create the type of consistent demand every month for that type of unique auction. We know that 10 and 30-year bonds already are part of the kind of pro forma in the sector. There's demand, there's history, there's steady eddies. To have the 20-year in between the two is going to immediately create demand versus over a long term, creating that sector for that long term bond that's more of an anomaly than an actual instrument of usage in the current environment by all the financial dealings on a day to day basis.
Yeah, very well put. People are skittish in these markets. They like consistency. They don't want something too wacky. Rick, thanks very much. And to that
point, we could have a couple of 100-year bond auctions, but I don't think it's the type of thing we're going to be having one every month. And really, that's what they need is these steady eddy auctions.
Yes, for the tons of issuance that we're about to see, this explosion. Rickster, thank you. We appreciate it, especially a big day like today. Rick Santelli with the auction results of the 20-year for us. Let me turn back to Kim Forrest. So we heard Bill Smead just talking about how the market might be set up. Typical of a change point to favor value after this long outperformance of growth, Kim. What would your response to that be? And why are you sticking with names like Microsoft, which is up 17% year to date?
Sure. Well, I think it's a simple sentence, right? Success begets success. I think that investors are always trying to invest in a company that's going to grow. And a lot of the companies that are in the value sector or that screen as a value are really not in a shape to grow. Like, let's just say banking. You know, if a 20-year bond is yielding 1.6, that net interest margin doesn't look really good to somebody who's making money off of that, you know, because it's hard to do. So I think a lot of the industries that have been found in value stocks just really have some fundamental issues with growth. And investors want their money to grow. And so they put them in stocks where they see growth has been and where there's a runway for them to grow. And I mean, I think that really is a simple answer.
Sure. And I know you also like Micron, you like Coca-Cola, which maybe we don't think of so much as a growth, and we can come back to that. But Bill, I want to give you a chance to respond and explain why you think a dollar would be better put in a stock like Discovery or Chevron or Wells Fargo right now.
Well, Kim is right, except that over 90 years of history, you could have made the same argument in 1972 for the Nifty 50, and you could have made the same argument for Microsoft, Cisco, and Intel in 1999. And the historical fact is that value has outperformed growth by 300 basis points a year on average over 90 years, with about half the time growth doing better than value, and about half the time value doing better than growth. And we've just finished up about a 10 or 12 year stretch, one of the longest in history, where growth has done better. The problem Kim's got is if you bring 500 experts in to talk on the other side from me on this subject, you're going to have about 400 of them say exactly what Kim said. And I'm not criticizing her because she's probably a great growth stock picker and has done fabulously. It's just the history of value is you do well because you pay way less for the future of the companies. And right now, that's an extreme of differential.
We're in the ring now. I can feel the tension, Kim. So please respond. And if you can, in context, mention why Coca-Cola falls into your stock basket right now. I'm just curious, since we're talking about growth, why that's a pick.
Sure. Well, I think it's fundamentally this time is different. The last 90 years, we've had this thing called the business cycle, where there was overproduction and companies would kind of fall into a recession because something would happen outside of the market, but, dry up demand. But this time it's really different. Companies are so well positioned that they did not go into a recession whenever the trade wars started because they were able to dial back what they were making. They knew it was in the warehouse. They knew through CRM what their demand was. So really, the business cycle has kind of lengthened out to just being a little bit lumpy as opposed to these big waves, right, that we saw whenever we took Economics 101. So why Coke? Well, I think they have some catalysts for growth. So they're not necessarily a growth name, but they have this catalyst for growth, which is great management and thinking out of the box about what they can provide to their customers. And they just have a great track record of doing that, at least with fizzy drinks and teas.
Sure.
And now they're moving into water. So that's kind of, the sparkling water stuff. So that's the short story on that. But this time it really is different. We are not having the classic business cycles.
I think that's fascinating. You guys know I'm a real macro person. So, Bill, respond to that. I mean, is it possible that some of the new kind of supply chain management systems, the high touch way that managers can get a look inside their business, is that smoothing out the business cycle?
Let's just think about this a little logically. Target just reported that they have spectacular sales and they're doing an incredibly good job on e-commerce. In fact, a very high percentage of the people come to the store to pick it up. But even though they're doing fantastic on e-commerce and many of the people are coming to the store to pick it up, it's nowhere near as profitable as a mom with two kids wandering through and buying apparel at the store. So the problem everybody's got right here is it's always different this time. It's always somewhat different. It always is. And those are the most damning words in investing because it's the rhymes that matter, not how they're perfectly in line with the prior situations. Coke was trading at 60 times earnings at the end of 72, and I was buying it in 81 at 6 times earnings, paying a 5% dividend. It went from a glamour growth stock to the dumper. Tech has a business cycle.
Okay.
Beware.
Okay.
We're not saying keep the same basket of stocks. Just look at the rationale differently. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying these winners are always going to win. I'm saying growth is always going to win. You always have to have the promise of growth. Nobody wants to buy a moribund stock. They just don't.
Absolutely. This has been fascinating and great. Thank you both today, Bill Smead and Kim Forrest, weighing in on this value growth dichotomy in the market. Coming up, new housing data is pointing to a big rebound in home buying. We're going to get the details on that. And speaking of real estate, the mega mansion is making a comeback amidst the pandemic. We'll have all the details. Plus, some positive news for the airline sector is sending stocks soaring over the past week. Is the sector now at a turning point? We'll debate that. Welcome back to The Exchange. Mortgage applications falling last week, but the real story is that a housing recovery appears to be underway. And speaking of which, it seems the mega mansion is making a comeback. Diana Olick is here to run through the overall housing stats for us, and Robert Frank has a look at the luxury segment. Diana, let's start with you.
Yeah, Kelly, buyers are coming back to the housing market far faster than anticipated. Mortgage applications to purchase a home specifically rose 6% last week from the previous week, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association. But look at that V. Purchase volume was just 1.5% lower than a year ago, which is really a stunning recovery from just 6 weeks ago when purchase volume was down 35% annually. And government purchase apps, which are FHA, VA, and USDA, generally for lower-income borrowers, those are now 5% higher than a year ago. Near-record low mortgage rates are part of it. The average on the 30-year fix fell to 3.41% for loans with 20% down. And there has been a lot of buzz this week about rates potentially falling below 3%. Some lenders are already there for top-tier borrowers, Kelly.
And we had a big upgrade on the street today, I think, maybe Evercore, which is saying, you know, but how much of this is, what are the builder stocks been doing?
They've actually been going up. I mean, yesterday when the overall market was down, you saw the home builders ETF, the construction ETF, which is ITB, was up on the day. And that was led by names like Lennar, Pulte, and Taylor Morrison. You also want to look at the names that have more entry-level homes like D.R. Horton and its Express Homes line. People are looking to get out to the suburbs and into new homes because there's just simply more of them for sale. We still have a very, very, very short supply of existing homes for sale.
Yep, the ones in my neighborhood were kind of sitting there before coronavirus, and is just in the last 3, 4, or 5 weeks, the buyers have really been flooding in. Diana, thanks. Let's turn to Robert Frank now to look at what's been going on with the buying boom in country estates, the mega mansions. Robert, what can you tell us?
Hey, Kelly, talking about flooding in, you know, you got wealthy New Yorkers looking to leave the city. They are buying the three P's right now, which is property, privacy, and a pool. The biggest estates in Westchester, Connecticut, northern New Jersey that sat on the market for years with a lot of price cuts are now in hot demand. This 4-acre waterfront spread in Greenwich just sold to a family moving out of the city. Price tag $17 million. That comes with its own golf green. Now, the Stone Mansion in Alpine, New Jersey, this has been on the market for 10 years. Now at $36 million after a $30 million price cut. Last month, a New York resident offered to rent it for $500,000 a month. The owner turned it down in hopes of a sale. And the late Leona Helmsley's former 40-acre estate in Greenwich, Connecticut, that had a big price drop from $50 million to $16 million. The broker says he's had 7 showings just in the past 2 months. We will see if that sells. Kelly, back to you.
Do you say the three P's were property, privacy, and a pool? That's yep. Learning stuff. So, I mean, makes sense. And there has been certainly a boom in people building pools. Robert, I'm curious. A couple of the ones that you highlighted are kind of these super mega high-end estates, and it's fascinating they're finally starting to move. What about the rest of them? And do you think this can be a lasting trend? I mean, it was 10 years, like you said, some of these properties have been sitting on the market. They might be seeing demand now, but do you think it's going to be a lasting shift?
Yeah, you're right. It's not just the mega mansions. The common denominator here is just space. People want a yard where their kids can go out and play. They can go out and play, and space interior, maybe an office, maybe more space for the rest of their family. We've been through phase one of this, which is just people leaving the city to rent. Now the big question, your question, which we don't know the answer to yet, is phase two, which is how many people permanently leave New York City and move to the suburbs. We've had a flood of rentals, rent rates doubling in the Hamptons, Connecticut, Hudson Valley. The question now, we're starting to see some buying, but it's early, and we'll see how many permanently leave the city with their kids, especially given that the school year is coming up and they have to make that decision soon.
Yeah, great point. Robert, thanks. Robert Frank, we appreciate
thanks.
It. We've got a market flash on some of the Chinese stocks. They've been volatile this afternoon. Deirdre Bosa has more for us. Deirdre?
Hey, Kelly, that's right. Chinese ADRs are taking a steep fall on some Senate headlines. A bill that could delist Chinese firms from U.S. exchanges was passed by unanimous consent not long ago. Now, the bill would require companies to certify that they are not owned or controlled by a foreign government. This is largely seen as aimed towards Beijing. Alibaba, as you can see, JD.com, Tencent Music, and others are down sharply on this news, between 2 and 4%. And Kelly, really, this bill underscores the growing anger among U.S. lawmakers towards China, its handling of COVID-19, and what they say are inadequate financial disclosures. Back to you.
So I wonder, though, I mean, we're talking about declines of 1.5%. They're not major, but Did you say they're talking about a delisting and then maybe in order to come back having to certify that they're not owned or controlled by a foreign government? I mean, that seems like a huge headache and is meant to be.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And Kelly, I think, though, this is going to happen over time. They have to see a number of quarters for this to happen. So there could be a belief that Chinese companies could find workaways around this. But and there's still the implementation of this. But they are coming off their highs and they are near the lows of the day. Tencent down more than 4%. And Alibaba, remember, is a huge billion-dollar market, many billion-dollar market cap company. So these are big drops for sizes of these stocks.
Yeah, that's true. Deirdre, thanks very much for the update. Deirdre Bosa with the latest there. Coming up, pharma companies are trying to develop new vaccines in a tenth of the usual time and manufacture them even faster. We're going to look at the race for a COVID cure. Plus, Sony is taking a unique approach to the streaming wars, that of arms dealer. The CEO will tell us why selling content to everyone is proving incredibly profitable. Remember, you can always watch or listen to us live on the go on the CNBC app. The Exchange is back in a couple. Welcome back. Let's get the very latest in the coronavirus pandemic. Over to Sue Herrera for that. Sue?
Thank you, Kelly. Good afternoon, everyone. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo today urging everyone to wear masks, adding that the reason first responders have lower infection rates is because the surgical masks work.
How do nurses and doctors have a lower infection rate than the general population? They're wearing the mask. The mask works. Those surgical masks work. And it's in the data.
Ford Motor confirmed today it closed and then reopened less than 24 hours later its Chicago assembly plant after two workers tested positive for the coronavirus. The company said the employees did not contract the virus while at work. You can head to CNBC.com for more on that story. Kelly, you're up to date. Back to you.
All right, Sue, thanks very much. Our Sue Herrera. Well, the drug industry has been given a monumental task to develop a vaccine faster than ever and get it out to the public even faster. While the science is actually moving along, the manufacturing could be a big stumbling block. Meg Terrell joins me now with a closer look. Meg?
Hey, Kelly, this is a huge challenge, manufacturing enough vaccine if these companies are successful in developing one to potentially serve the entire world. Experts tell me we do not yet have the manufacturing capacity to get that done, but work is underway now to try to make that happen. And a big part of that is forging partnerships between companies. Take a look at some of the ones we've seen already. Johnson & Johnson is working with Emergent BioSolutions and plans to bring on more partners with the goal of manufacturing more than a billion doses of their potential vaccine. Moderna is working with Lonza in order to do a billion doses per year, potentially. Other collaborations like the University of Oxford working with AstraZeneca, Pfizer and BioNTech working together and may bring on more partners, as well as GSK and Sanofi putting a goal of more than a billion doses by the first half of 2021. What a lot of these partnerships depend on is a part of the market we almost never talk about, contract development and manufacturing organizations. This is a large and growing part of how our medicines get made. In 2018, PwC estimated they brought in about $99 billion in revenue, and that's projected to grow to almost $160 billion by 2025. These are companies like Emergent BioSolutions and like Lonza. Now, there are many questions about what's going to happen with this manufacturing, particularly because a lot of these vaccines depend on technology that's never been deployed before. So they're kind of building the plane as they're flying it, trying to figure out how to make these things in such large quantities. The other question, of course, is the supply chain. And we saw it with testing and with ventilators. What are the weak points in the supply chain? We just don't know yet. But we did ask that question to the Lonza CEO this morning on Squawk Box. What keeps him up at night? Here's what he said.
What could go wrong and create some delays is having access to the equipment. We are building new plants, new manufacturing lines with specific equipment. And this is the main reason why we could be delayed in our timelines.
The other thing he said he needs, Kelly, is funding. And that's even after Moderna received almost $500 million from BARDA, the U.S. government. And of course, this week did a $1.25 billion stock sale. Even with that, the Lonza CEO says more funding is needed to get this done.
Yeah, so I guess the issue is, where is that funding going to come from, or what kind of top-down push are we going to see to make sure that the manufacturing is in place, not just so that we can get out quickly, Meg, but also, and I sense this a lot, so that the public can trust this vaccine. They understand where it came from. They understand, you know, kind of every step of the process along the way so that they trust it.
That's so important. The safety of these vaccines will obviously have to be proven in big studies, and people will have to feel very safe taking them. But you bring up a great point about where that funding is going to come from. There are groups like one known as CEPI, as well as the Gates Foundation, that are talking about investing here. But one problem I'm hearing about is that, you know, governments aren't yet placing orders for these vaccines because there's so many projects going on and they're all at such early stages, they don't know where to place their bets. So they can't be placing these orders yet. And without that money, some of the companies can't invest in the manufacturing. It's sort of catch-22.
Interesting. Well, then I guess we just hope the science keeps moving along quickly and clarifying that for us. Meg, thanks very much. We appreciate it. Meg Terrell with a closer look at what that vaccine manufacturing will take. Coming up starting today, all 50 states are now partially back open for business, some more so than others. We're going to speak with the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, about its reopening and if demand is back. Plus, the United CEO says things are not as bad as they once were. Could that be a sign for investors that it's time to get back in? We'll explore where to invest in the airline space. And speaking of positive, Walmart CEO Doug McMillon telling CNBC that spending is continuing and people are getting optimistic about going back to work.
It's clear that people have been at home and they look around and they think, you know, I want to replace that lamp, or I want to replace that office desk. And then they started thinking about the outdoors as they got out into the backyard and the front yard, and they realized they needed to do some landscaping. So we've certainly seen those categories take off. So right now, people are starting to think about, in some cases, going back to work. And we've seen those trends show up in the health and beauty aids categories and footwear.
Welcome back to The Exchange. A rally across the board with the Nasdaq up 1.75% right now, 160 points. Let's get a check on all of the movers with Dom Chu. Dom?
All right, so Kelly, the bulls are in charge today, at least for now. We did see those gains, remember, yesterday evaporate into the closing bell. Now, at session highs, the Dow was up 442 points. The S&P was up roughly 58. Again, focusing on some of the key levels to watch in the S&P 500, the 200-day moving average, or average price, is currently just around $29.99. So you can see there, close, but not just there yet. Now, from a sector perspective, not a speck of red on the screen so far. Those gains being led by energy, communication services, and financials. Meanwhile, the laggards, you can see, consumer staples, utilities, real estate, and healthcare. Now, some stocks to watch today include, over here, Harley-Davidson, up about 5%. The motorcycle maker is reopening its manufacturing plants with reduced capacity. They will also be producing more limited slates of models. That's according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. And then you have shares of medical products and technology company Becton Dickinson, the biggest laggard in the S&P, after it said it would raise more capital by selling various types of shares. And we'll end on Amazon.com, which is trading at a new record high, as you can see there, making it worth, Kelly, $1.24 trillion. Back over to you.
That, Dom, you sound a little out of breath.
It's been a pretty crazy afternoon so far.
We appreciate it, sir. Thank you,
you
Dom Chu. As of today, all 50 states are now either open or starting to reopen. Alabama's biggest city, which is Birmingham, began a partial opening last week, including restaurants and bars, gyms, salons, and churches. The city also launched a new program that enlists recently unemployed workers as paid volunteers to meet community needs. Joining me to talk about what the reopening process has been like is Randall Wood, the mayor of Birmingham, Alabama. Mayor, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Kelly. Thank you for having me on.
So, and one of the interesting things that caught everybody's attention was you guys at one point had a curfew, which you've since done away with. What was the rationale behind that? And in general, how are you learning as the reopening process evolves about what's helping the most in all of that?
Well, the first thing we did was have a 24-hour curfew, actually, a shelter-in-place order, because we wanted to make sure we were protecting the health of our community and of our residents. When the state moved to reopen things, we thought it was premature. And because of that, we wanted to make sure, in alignment with things being open, such as retail, if retail was going to close at 10 p.m., then we felt that people needed to be at home at 10 to make sure people weren't out participating in activities that would promote community spread. I think since more things have been open, what we wanted to do is not only do away with that, but enact other things in place to make sure we protect people. And so we now have a facial cover ordinance to make sure that if people are going to be out and are practicing, not practicing social distancing, then the facial cover is put in place to make sure that there is not more community spread.
It's interesting you say you were kind of dragged into the reopening. Now, there's a lot of different reasons why. I mean, Birmingham obviously is more urban than the rest of Alabama. It's kind of a blue ring in a very red state as well. And your population is very vulnerable to COVID. So explain some of the hesitancy there. And as you kind of start to allow places to reopen, are people coming back? What's demand like?
And so the hesitancy is double. It's in one hand, we have 1 out of 5 people over the age of 60. 3 out of 4 people are Black. Unfortunately, we have too many people with underlying health conditions and pre-existing conditions that lend itself to, if they catch the COVID, it's harder for them to recover. You add on top of that, we are in a urban dense city. We have the highest population within the state of Alabama. And then you add on top of that, our cases continue to increase. Just over the last 7 days, we've had 197 new cases and 14 people have died from the COVID-19. When you add all of that together, clearly we have to do things that are very different from the other cities within the state of Alabama. As it relates to the other part of your question, I believe that as elected officials, we cannot predict consumer behavior because there's still fear and anxiety of people coming out. I think what we have to do is find more creative, innovative ways to ease some of that fear by, let's say, closing down the street. And instead of people eating inside, possibly they can eat outside of a restaurant. I think we have to come up with other creative ways like that to make sure we decrease that fear and anxiety.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you also, or we mentioned this program that you have to rehire furloughed workers. Now, so people know, Birmingham is a very industrial city. I think you do a lot of car and related manufacturing there as well, which has been a hard hit industry. So how does that program work where you take furloughed workers and what are they doing for the city? And how long do you anticipate that that can continue?
Well, it's twofold. Birmingham Strong was created to support the employers who we know only had about 14 days of cash flow. And so through a public-private partnership, we raised about $2.4 million to support small businesses within our city. That program supported not only 90 businesses, but it was laser focused for legacy businesses and minority businesses. In addition to that, the Birmingham Strong supported these hourly workers who have been laid off. We've had about 800 people to apply, and so far we've hired about 145 people who are being paid anywhere between $13 and $22 an hour to support the COVID-related issues. And so this is a ready-to-work program for those hourly employees who've been laid off, but also supports the community work we need in response to the COVID-19 emergency.
And like you said, kind of helps restore confidence somewhat so that people aren't so overwhelmed by the crisis. Mayor Woodfin, it's great to hear all of that. Good luck with it. We're, you know, obviously sorry that the coronavirus has been so hard on your city. We'll be watching to see what other efforts you have to take. But thanks for joining me today to discuss it.
Kelly, thank you so much.
That's Mayor Randall Woodfin of Birmingham, Alabama. Still ahead, as theaters are closed and people are streaming more from their couch, Apple TV just paid Sony big bucks for Tom Hanks's newest flick. The CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment joins us to talk about that and the future of the movie industry in general as more companies eschew theatrical releases. The Exchange is back in two. Welcome back. When it comes to the streaming wars, Sony Entertainment took a different route than most of its competitors and chose not to launch their own service. Instead, they've become something like an arms dealer to the industry by selling their content to everybody, to the highest bidder. Today, the company proved just how lucrative that can be, striking a $70 million deal with Apple TV for streaming rights to Sony's new Tom Hanks movie. With us now to talk about that strategy and more, Julia Borson joins us with Sony Pictures Entertainment CEO Tony Vinciquerra. Julia?
Thanks so much, Kelly. And Tony, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Hi, Julia. How are you doing today?
Good. So interesting to have you come talk to us on the heels of this big deal to sell a movie that was intended for theatrical release in June to Apple TV Plus. Now, what I'm wondering here is why you didn't just delay the release as Sony and so many other studios have. Why did you decide to sell it to streaming instead?
Well, Julie, as you know, there are tremendous unknowns about when theaters will open and how many people will be allowed into theaters, what the percentage are, what the percentage of seats that will be allowed to be filled. And there, when theaters do open, there's going to be a tremendous logjam of films. So dating films right now is a really difficult process, as you would expect. So, you know, we have this opportunity, and this is not a practice that we expect to see happen many times, but we'll see a few times. We are completely committed to the theatrical world and theatrical business, and that is our primary business. But this opportunity arose, and we took it.
Now, you did reschedule a number of big films to early next year. I believe you have one in January, March. But tell us about your outlook for movie going. I mean, are you concerned that audiences just won't be ready to get back to theaters this fall? Do you think that audiences will return at more typical numbers next year?
We think that theaters will provide a safe environment for people to go back to theaters. It will take a little while, I think, for people to have the energy and enthusiasm to go back to theaters. But we do believe it's going to happen. Just look at what's happening when the beaches are opening around the country. People are flocking to them, maybe not in the safest, best way, but people are anxious to get back to their normal lives. And we do think that theaters will return in a very strong way, albeit with some restrictions.
But it sounds like you think maybe not until next year.
It's hard to tell. There are so many variables at work here, not only on the theatrical experience, but on the production experience, which is another big variable that has many, many constituents who will have an opinion about how productions will begin and as you mentioned, how theaters will reopen.
Now, speaking of production, how much has your content pipeline been impacted by the essential production shutdown almost everywhere? And when do you think you'll be able to start to get productions up and running again?
Well, you know, we're completely shut down. We have 50 TV shows on air in various platforms in the U.S., virtually every platform in the U.S., and we have about 60 other international productions on the air. Some of those international productions have already begun in Germany and a few other places, primarily and non-scripted, have begun production. So we're starting to see a little bit of thawing of that side of the business. In the U.S., there are a number of constituents who will have to agree to go back to work, and those conversations are happening right now. And look, I'm hoping that by September we'll be able to see late August, early September, we'll be able to see some productions get back to work. There are some places around the world where productions will begin a little earlier. Czechoslovakia, for instance, where we have a TV show filming, we have a movie filming in Germany. We're hoping to get back up and running. And there's a few other places that things could happen more quickly.
One thing we're trying to understand is how the movie industry could be really permanently changed by coronavirus and the resulting impacts of it. And one thing I'm curious about is this idea of simultaneous release between at home, when movies are released at home and also in theaters, or even shortening the window between when movies are released in theaters and then available on demand. This has been a big debate between AMC and Universal. Where do you stand on this? Do you want to be able to do simultaneous release?
No. We think that the theatrical release is vitally important to the film industry and to generating the most revenue and profit. We just have not seen models where that kind of release schedule will benefit the profitability and the efficacy of major productions. We haven't seen a way forward that could work. So, look, we are completely committed to the theatrical business at this point.
Certainly a fascinating time, and we'll have to see when that theatrical business does come back. Tony Vinciquerra, thank you so much for talking to us, and we hope you'll be back to talk to us again. Kelly, back over to you.
Absolutely, Julia. Thank you for your time.
My thanks to both of you as well. Tony Vinciquerra, the CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment, and our own Julia Boorstin. Coming up, we're sticking with entertainment. Goldman Sachs making a big call on the music industry. We'll have the details and which names will benefit next. As we head to break, take a look at the Internet ETF, the FDN. At another all-time high today, up 51% from its March low, led by the likes of Facebook, Expedia, DocuSign, and Twitter. We're back after this.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Well, the show must go on eventually, according to Goldman Sachs. They're making a bullish call on the music industry today, saying despite a 25% drop in global music revenue and a 75% drop in live events because of coronavirus, this industry will bounce back over the next couple of years. Goldman sees up to $142 billion in revenues, which is four times last year's number by the end of the decade. This due to secular growth of paid streaming, demand for content, new licensing opportunities, and positive regulatory developments. The analyst said record companies like Universal and Sony will be big winners, but streaming platforms will also benefit. They prefer Spotify and Tencent in that space. Spotify, though, is still hedging its bets on the music industry, striking a $100 million deal with the Joe Rogan podcast for exclusive rights to the massively popular Joe Rogan Experience. The shares spiked on that announcement yesterday and are continuing to climb today. They're up another 7% to hit an all-time high. Still ahead, some positive news out of the airlines over the past few days. United, Delta, and Southwest all saying there's been a slight uptick in demand. Does this mark a real turning point for the industry? And can the stocks recover their previous highs? A bull bear debate is next. And we're less than 10 minutes away from the Fed's April minutes. That's coming up in Power Lunch. Stay with us. We're back in two. Memorial Day weekend is normally the start of a busy travel season for the airlines, but not this year. The new CEO of United joined Squawk Box this morning with his thoughts on when demand will return.
Obviously, while we're in the worst financial crisis in the history of aviation, the opportunity to get through to the other side is really bright. And while it's too early to, you know, say we see the light at the end of the tunnel yet, it's certainly a lot less dark in here than it was a few months ago. We don't know what demand will be in the fourth quarter and the first quarter. No one knows what the recovery is going to look like.
And United is one of the worst airline stocks this year, underperforming its peers by more than 70%. For more, I'm joined by Brandon Oglenski. He's airline analyst at Barclays, and Joe DiNardi is the airline analyst at Stifel. It's nice to have you both here. Brandon, let me start with you and where you think the airline sector can start to price in the kind of recovery that we're seeing in other parts of the stock market.
Yeah, well, good afternoon, Kelly, and thanks for having us back on again. Look, I know everyone's excited here when we hear, you know, news about vaccines or people getting back to traveling. And I know Southwest and a few others have said, hey, look, we're coming off the bottom. Maybe revenue's not down 95. It's only down, you know, 90 to 85%. But the big issue here is really not what's going to happen in the next few quarters, but where does travel demand go in 2021? And the best that we can guess is really probably down 20% from where we were in 2019. And maybe that doesn't even happen as fast as next year because we need to have places to go to. I mean, restaurants at 50% capacity, wearing a face mask at Disney, are these things that are going to be really fun that you want to spend a lot of money, you know, with your family to go travel to? And more importantly, if we're going to put restrictions, you know, like some carriers have said, we're not going to, you know, book the middle seat, then airfare is going to have to go up in the midst of a lot of unemployment here. So I get it. I know people want to play the recovery. These airline stocks are down 50 to 60%, but you have to look at the debt balance here. Americans going to come out of this, you know, if they survive with conservatively probably $35 billion of debt. Delta, wow. United, somewhere around $20 billion. You know, don't forget pension liabilities are going to approach $10 billion for some of these companies as well. And if you look at historical valuations and most likely compressed earnings next year, the valuations are already kind of there.
You know, one of the debates, Joe, that we've been having and kind of hearing different points of view on is whether the airlines are going to see consolidation, bankruptcies. I mean, what the options really are here, because as our Phil LeBeau said, it's unlikely that regulators would want us to go from four major airlines to fewer than that right now. So where does that leave everybody?
Yeah, I think it depends on the extent to which the revenue environment comes back. If you end up with just a structurally reduced revenue environment because corporate travelers aren't flying as much, then I think you're going to need consolidation. This was an industry with relatively thin profit margins to begin with and a lot of capital intensity. So you can't assume that if revenues end up being 70% of what they were for a multi-year period, that there won't be consolidation. There pretty much has to be. And I think it really depends on how quickly pricing and demand comes back in fourth quarter. The issue is, I think, a lot less about liquidity and when American, to a lesser extent, United just says kind of the hole that we've dug is too deep, even if we raise additional capital, because they can raise a ton of cash against their loyalty programs. But you would emerge from that essentially competitively disadvantaged to Southwest. And so I think that's really what we're worried about, what makes American and United to a lesser extent kind of uninvestable at this point is if the revenue environment takes longer to come back, at some point the board may say we can raise additional cash, but what's the point?
Right.
We need to start over.
So I want to sneak in one more to each of you real quickly here. So Joe, that being said, who could consolidate?
Yeah, well, Southwest has the liquidity, the firepower, and probably the political capital to be a consolidator. So if you look at their network, the two holes in that in the network are in the Pacific Northwest and in the New York area.
Mm-hmm. JetBlue and Alaska. Yep.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then I think beyond that, it would be the others, Delta, any other airline that was in a financial position to consolidate would try and find a partner.
Okay. And Joe, I know you talked when we were talking about the Boeing MAX crisis about how Southwest might need to do something strategic. It could certainly do that for a lot less now. So real quickly, Brandon, back to you then. And both of you have been extremely cautious about investing in the airlines, citing these massive debt loads. So what happens next? I mean, what are the other alternatives? What's going to happen to the industry?
Well, I would take it even a step further. I mean, Southwest, I got to hand it to them. They run the best airline probably in the world, and they ran it with no debt, very modest, investments over the years. And that's really playing true now because we actually think they could get to the other side of this. So we do get some travel demand back, by next year with almost no net debt. And they're going to be in the driver's seat potentially even to take load factors down, take fares down, and, make some competitive pressures even without industry M&A. So this is going to be a pretty difficult landscape with a carrier that has no debt, and then like an American that's going to come out of this with $35 billion.
That's unbelievable. I know exactly what you're saying. No net debt versus some of those incredible loads. Thank you both. Very illuminating. Brandon Oglenski and Joe DeNardi talking about maybe what not to do in the airline space. That does it for The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.